latest news from Financeland with Wiley Sims from Smartline, station sponsor.
The information provided in this segment is general advice only. Listeners should seek individual advice from their accountant, financial advisor or broker to see if the product is right for their situation. ACL number 385325.
And good morning to you, Wiley. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be back, Mitch. Good morning. Good morning, Courtney, and good morning, listeners.
Morning, Wiley.
Now, you were away for a PD day last week, and you've learned a lot, which you're going to be sharing with the listeners in just a moment. But looking at what's been happening in Financeland this week, we've actually got a figure now that values all of the Australian homes.
Yes. RP Data CoreLogic just released their July results for the value of Australian homes, and this will be an amazing figure, Mitch. It's $6 trillion. Now, being a poor mathematician, I had to go to the internet to figure out what a trillion was, and I found that that's $6,000 billion worth of real estate tied up in Australia, which is really quite amazing. But it was an interesting figure. Only 1.3 trillion of that is actually tied up in bank asset loans, which means that a lot of Australians or a lot of people own their homes, which is rather interesting. Some interesting figures dropped out of that is that Melbourne's replaced Sydney with the highest rates of capital gain in the last 3 months, and Melbourne is currently running at around about 6.1% per annum. The weakest performing capital is Darwin, but the good thing about Darwin is it's got the highest rental yields, and of course Melbourne has the lowest rental yields, so that was rather interesting. The reason for this is a lot of appreciation in housing prices, and also new construction that's come online as well. So $6 trillion, and again, you might have to look it up on Wikipedia to try and figure out how much a trillion is. It's very hard to get your head around how much that is in terms of dollar notes.
All I can think about is our GDP, I think, is about $1.1 or $1.2 trillion a year. So that's sort of saying something, I suppose, if our property is worth six times our economy.
And, of course, it's a worry if indeed we do get a depreciation in that. You can imagine the repercussions that it will have across the economy. And this is why the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority has been so hard on investment lending, and we'll talk a little bit more about that shortly.
I find it interesting that Melbourne capital gains were more than Sydney, because I've been reading some stories recently that say that Melbourne's population is going to overtake Sydney's at some time over this century. So does that mean that the value of the Melbourne property market will be greater than Sydney at one point, do you think?
It very well could, Mitch. It will depend a lot on supply and availability of supply, because the problem with Sydney, of course, it's hemmed in by the escarpment behind it, and they really can't spread west anymore. And Sydney's been spreading up and down the coast, encroaching on Wollongong and Newcastle, where Melbourne can spread a little bit more. So it will depend largely on government policy and how much land is released. I suspect as the population grows here, there certainly will be increase in real estate. And again, anyone who's in the real estate market, it's going to be very good for accumulation of their wealth.
And some property investors have been exposed to new lending regulations?
Yeah, what's happening is because of the changes with investment lending, particularly the loan-to-value ratio, and the fact that some of the banks have increased the interest rates, we may find that particularly people who have bought off the plan may find themselves exposed and not being able to fulfil their obligations and actually complete their purchase. Now, the amazing thing is that as we sit here now, there are around about 90,000 off-the-plan apartments currently under construction, of which people have actually spent deposits on those. So some of those people, if they can't refinance and can't find a way out of this hole, they're either going to have to find more deposit, or if they can't do that, they may face a very real possibility of losing their deposits. So again, that's going to have a ripple effect on the real estate market. We may find, in fact, that there will be a lot of newly completed apartments come on the market. So again, we expect as brokers that we are going to get inquiries from some of these people who can't go through their normal lending channels.
And you've found some places where it might be wise not to invest. I don't think this result will surprise anyone, but where do you think it is?
Yeah, well, we've been occasionally we'll get investors coming to us and wanting to purchase property in these mining towns, and what we've found is that the the mining town's property prices have halved in the last 2 years.
Really?
And we've found that there's going to be some mum and dad investors that are going to get burnt on this quite badly. For example, in Moranbah in Queensland, the median property prices plunged from $740,000 in December 2012 to currently around about $310,000.
Staggering.
So there are going to be people out there holding big mortgages on some of these where, in fact, there's very little equity, in fact, negative equity in these properties. Karratha, again, from $900,000 in 2012 down to around about $550,000. It's interesting that property prices in Melbourne and Sydney have increased about 25% in this period.
Yeah.
So what we're finding is people that have largely speculated on these markets and expected these booms to continue may find that they're going to be in a lot of financial trouble. Again, it's a risk with anything, with investment. There is risk associated, and if you're going to go for these windfall gains that were occurring in some of these mining towns, you can also go for windfall losses. So what's also happened with that is many of the mining companies are actually now relying on fly-in, fly-out workers, yeah, and they're not actually building townships to support their mining activities as well. So again, some of these are pretty staggering. Dysart in Queensland, median price from around about $570,000 down to $120,000. We've already mentioned Port Hedland, down from $1.59 million in 2012 down to around about a mere $970,000 in Port Hedland. And Blackwater from around about $450,000 to $280,000. So again, let's hope none of our listeners had invested in these mining towns, because unfortunately their value these days is around about half of what they were 2 years ago.
I suppose it's not that surprising, because a lot of these places aren't necessarily the most desirable places to live in Australia. If they didn't have mines there, they probably wouldn't be given a second look. You know, so it's probably been overheating for some time. But that said, some of those numbers that you've read out there and the rate at which they've collapsed is just staggering.
Yeah, well, I think it's a pullback in the workforce, is the fact that many of these mining sites have gone from the construction stage of the mines now to the production stage, so in the workforces are nowhere near as big. And, of course, that's got huge social implications for the towns as well, where they're going to have a lot of vacancies there, maybe oversupply of services, displaced people in the service industries, etc. So it's not just the investors that are going to get hurt. It's going to hurt the economies right across those townships as well.
Yep.
And have big social implications in those towns as well.
Now, this week's suburb review is Lovely Banks. What have you found?
Yeah, Lovely Banks, really interesting. We can see that Lovely Banks is trending nicely above the median prices for Greater Geelong of around about $400,000. Recent sales have been around $450,000, but Lovely Banks seems to be a bit of a kind of a two-horse, two-paced horse race. We find that there are some smaller and more humble properties in the older part of the suburb, which are sub 400, but again, we've got real estate that's been released, some of the larger blocks up on the hill area there that are around about $450,000, $500,000. So who knows, it might be a good suburb to invest in if you can get one of these more humble blocks, but certainly you need a few dollars in your pocket if you're going to look in Lovely Banks.
It's a bit of a diverse suburb, because I imagine there's a few big places there, and as you said, some of the humble places that were associated with the old Lovely Banks.
Yeah, exactly, Mitch, and certainly some of those new McMansions that are going up on the hill there would be well into the six-digit figures.
Yep. Now, looking at last week's meeting that you had with lenders and your PD there, tell us what you've uncovered.
Well, Mitch, as a broker, I felt a little bit like I've been against the ropes, getting king hit by Mike Tyson with so many changes to policies that have been happening in the last few weeks. And it was nice to talk to my peers and find that I'm not the only one that's struggling to keep abreast of it. In fact, at Smartline, we've had to employ additional administrative staff and head office just to keep our systems updated and be able to provide real-time advice, because it's almost on a daily basis we're getting hit with new policy changes. And I thought with as professional brokers are having trouble keeping pace of the changes, I thought that we might just have a change the format this week and try and get our listeners a little bit up to speed on some of these policy changes and what's happening with these policies.
Yeah, I think that's a useful exercise. I suppose you have to go back to the root cause. What's actually caused all of these changes?
Well, regular listeners of Finance Land would know that we've been talking about two things. One is largely driven by the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, or APRA. that's directed at all deposit-taking institutions, mainly banks, will have to limit their growth in investment properties to 10%. Now, this has fueled changes to investment rates and loan-to-value ratios largely for investors. But every lender has seemed to have taken a different path to achieve this. For example, some have changed interest rates for investment loans. We've already mentioned changes to loan-to-value ratios. Some have changed investment rates, and some have changed the way that investment income is assessed. Some will no longer count negative gearing in the equation, etc. So every lender's taken their own path. And secondly, well, probably about 3 months ago, I just gave one of those throwaway lines about Basel III, which is Swiss banking, which again controls a lot of national international banking, recommend that all banks across the world increase their capital holding. And they've recommended that Australian banks to become unquestionably strong and robust to be able to handle financial crises in the future must hold 25% of capitals. And this is a directive that the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority said by June 2006, all deposit holding institutions, and you can read that as banks, credit unions, etc., but mainly banks, 25% of their capital must be held. Now, it's been a challenge for the big four banks in particular, and some of the other banks as well, because they've geared quite heavily in terms of their capital. So many of these banks don't have anywhere near that 25%, meaning that they've had to raise capital. It's been an opportunity for some of the smaller lenders who've actually had to raise their money through different paths and have actually already achieved that. And we'll talk a little bit about more of that in a moment. So these smaller banks are not as highly geared, so therefore they've got an opportunity. So what we've found from this is an increase in interest rates for both new and existing investment loans by many banks. Now, the banks have been possibly unfairly criticised about this because a lot of the media press has been saying that the banks are actually profit gouging, but they've actually had to increase the capital. As we said, the banks have taken a number of ways to do this. And also they've been rebalancing the capital risk profile of their investment loans as well. And indeed, when you're talking before about NAB, and NAB not being comfortable with some of the suburbs that they're lending in, it's not uncommon. We've had ING, for example, completely stop lending in some of the western suburbs around Tarneaton, Werribee, etc. for a time a few years ago. And again, it's partly balancing their risk profile, where they just don't want to be overly exposed in certain suburbs, particularly where, and the reason for Tarneaton at that time is that the properties were not valuing for what people were paying for a time there.
Do you know of any suburbs in Geelong, just incidentally, that have been subject to this sort of blacklisting, or you know, that the lenders can have a second look before they approve your application?
At the moment, no, but again, it will depend upon lender upon lender. We generally find that if a lender, for example, when ING and currently NAB is frowning upon certain suburbs, and ING in the past, we could always get funding for those people from other lenders as well. You would have to have a grave crisis of oversupply or a nuclear bomb going off or something in a suburb for it to be really avoided by all lenders.
Now, how much have the banks actually needed to raise?
Yeah, this is quite staggering, Mitch. What we've found is the big four alone have had to raise $18 billion.
Wow.
And they've all taken different paths to doing this. You may recall a couple of weeks ago, ANZ ceased trading for a day because they were actually doing some issues. Westpac's been achieving this by dividend reinvestment, and NAB has also had some capital investment. So CBA alone has had to raise $8 billion by June next year, NAB $5.5 billion, ANZ $3 billion, and Westpac $2 billion. Macquarie has also had to raise capital, and a number of the other banks as well. So they've all taken different paths to do this, and in some cases they may not have achieved it through share issue, and now they've had to actually take funds really away from their investment portfolio.
Now, these changes only really affect investors, is that right?
Well, up to last Tuesday, I would have probably agreed with you, Mitch, but it's come to, I've become more aware that it's actually now filtering down into owner-occupiers as well. Although it's mainly affecting investors at present, it's owner occupiers are being affected, and in subtle ways that may not be that apparent. As I said, each lender has taken a different approach, so we can't generalise that every lender is doing it the same way. But many of the larger banks have increased their assessment rates. Now, just to remind our lenders, listeners, what assessment rates are, it's the buffer that lenders apply to the interest rate to ensure that you can keep paying your loan should there be changes in the future. That buffer used to be about 1.5% to 2% on the interest rate that you were actually borrowing at. So if you're borrowing at 4.5%, you would have had a buffer of around about 6%, 6.5%. The lenders have now increased this buffer to 7 or 7.25%, irrespective of the interest rate you're paying. That basically means that you need more income to be able to service the same amount of borrowing. So it will reduce for some borrowers the amount they can borrow. For others, they'll need more income to be able to borrow the same amount. There's also been a decrease in the maximum loan-to-value ratios. Now, I've done a good job of being able to tell our listeners how it's been affecting investors. But it's filtering now through to owner-occupiers. For example, Commonwealth Bank previously would allow you to borrow up to 97% of the value of the property. They've now, that's including lenders' mortgage insurance. They've now brought that figure down to 95%, including lenders' mortgage insurance. 2% doesn't sound much, but if you're saving hard for your first home, you might have saved $25,000, $30,000 to get into that first home. You now find you're going to need $35,000 because that 2% is critical for many borrowers. Bankwest have reduced their maximum loan-to-value ratio to 95%, including lenders' mortgage insurance, where previously they would have lent at 95% plus unlimited lenders' mortgage insurance, which meant you could have borrowed maybe up to 98, 98.5%. Again, that's going to hurt because that was a favoured bank by many new home buyers. That's going to affect people's ability to be able to borrow through Bankwest. And most lenders really have increased their living expenses calculations in the last few weeks as well. And the living expenses, that's the amount that you need to retain to be able to pay for your basic essentials, power, electricity, food, entertainment, etc. And they've all gone up. The result is it's getting tighter for both investors and owner-occupiers to get approval at the level that they previously could in the past.
Can you give us just a quick summary on the changes that you've talked about?
Yeah, sure, Mitch. Well, one bank has got out of investor lending altogether, AMP Bank. They no longer will lend to investors at all, full stop. Another no longer does self-managed super fund loans. We find that loan-to-value ratios have increased for investment loans, and depending on which lender you're looking at. Some are now at 90%, some at 80%, and some as low as 60%. And again, each bank's taken a different path here, and also I suspect they're also reweighting their risk portfolio. We've already mentioned that increased serviceability rates up to 7.25% have come in, depending on the lender. And we're starting to see that owner-occupied loan-to-value ratios are changing as well. And it's interesting to see that some of the banks have actually used different policies even within their group, with one of the majors having increased interest rates for investors, where another, with one of their subsidiaries, which is a major lending path to what we call white label products, which some of the brokers use, have increased the interest rates for interest-only loans. So, in fact, although they haven't changed their policy, if you've got interest-only, which investors tended to favour, they've increased the interest rates for that. So it's really... Every lender's taken a different path, and that's what's making it really tough for us to keep our head up and around the lending space. And we have to rely more and more on our database now to actually give accurate and timely information to our prospective borrowers.
Do these changes affect all lenders?
No, Mitch. It's only affecting deposit-taking institutions, mainly banks and credit unions. Many of the second-tier lenders or private lenders are unaffected by this, and in fact some of these second-tier lenders are actually seeing it as an opportunity and they're touting for business, particularly the investment loans. Some of them go through a process known as securitisation, where they actually will bundle their loans together and sell these offshore in terms of their risk portfolio. And many of these companies like Liberty, Resimac, for example, actually at this stage are not affected, and it's unlikely that they will be. And so we've found many of them offering really great deals to people that can't go through traditional channels to actually get their funding.
And specials this week for the listeners?
Well, Mitch, I'd suggest that anyone who's affected by some of these changes have a talk to their brokers, because any broker's going to have a wide range of lenders, particularly if their current lender says no or they can't proceed in their existing loan arrangements. Some of the specials that we've got: Bank of Melbourne have matched Heritage Bank at 4.19% with their basic home loan offer. CUA has got a 3-year fixed at 4.25%, or you can get it at 4.59% 3-year fixed if you want an offset facility, and that's pretty good to be able to get offset for 3 years at 4.59%. Liberty, as we mentioned before, is offering this sensational 4.14% at 90% loan-to-value ratio with only a $295 a year ongoing fee, which is a great opportunity for investors that have been bitten by these tighter rules. And a number of banks again offering owner occupier, and we've still got four lenders offering to pay lenders mortgage insurance up to 85%.
And next week, what will we be talking about?
Well, next week, Mitch, I thought we might get back to what we were going to talk about, and that's buying your first home. We might have a little bit of a chat about family guarantee and how the first home buyer grant works. And anyone who's interested in having a chat to me about any of these changes or needs a bit of advice can always ring me on 1300 280 342 and always happy to give them some advice there, Mitch.
Thank you so much, Wiley Sims there from Smartline.
The information provided in this segment is general advice only. Listeners should seek individual advice from their accountant, financial advisor or broker to see if the product is right for their situation. ACL number 385325.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.